Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Ready to call the first case today and the last case for the March calendar, 09AP1209CR, State versus Brian T. St. Martin. Representing Mr. St. Martin is Attorney Michael Gould, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. I am Assistant Public Defender Michael Gould for the appellant Brian St. Martin. The issue that was certified to this court by the Court of Appeals concerns the rule established in Georgia versus Randolph, which is that a warrantless search of a residence cannot be justified on the basis of consent by one tenant when a physically present co-tenant refuses consent prior to the search. The question here is whether that rule would still apply in a situation where the police officers have removed the co-tenant, Mr. St. Martin, from the residence and have detained him outside the apartment building in a police van, which is where he was asked to consent to the search of the attic and where he refused to consent. And this took place after his girlfriend, LaToya, had told the police that they could consent. The point to keep in mind in considering this is that, you know, the overriding rule is that consent is a closely guarded exception to the Fourth Amendment, which in general prohibits warrantless searches of people's homes in the absence of an exception. Mr. St. Martin respectfully submits because that he remained at the scene, was only removed from the apartment through the agency of the police. He was inside the apartment when the police arrived. They used LaToya's key to enter, and they found him inside. He was taken outside involuntarily because he was placed under arrest and put in the van. We would submit that removal does not take Mr. St. Martin's refusal outside the scope of the admittedly narrow but bright-line rule established in Georgia versus Randolph.
Counsel, one of the things that drives the jurisprudence in this area is the desire that there not be manipulation. And indeed, in the Randolph case, the court was expressly made reference to that concern. A concern I have, and another concern is you don't want to give a disincentive to good police work either, and which good police work wouldn't rely on just manipulating around the rules. Problem I have with this case is I'm not sure the police even had to ask him. And if they didn't ask him, wouldn't the search be legal?
I would have to answer yes, because I see nothing in the authorities that have been cited in any brief that say that police have to ask the question. But remember, when they do ask the question, they don't know what the answer is going to be. In very many cases, when they ask to consent, in really an extraordinary number of cases, the person says, yeah, you can go ahead and search. I think there's a kind of, you know, if you have something to hide, you don't want to show that. By denying consent, you're almost admitting you've got something to hide. So many people probably say, yeah, go ahead, in the hopes that that won't take place, thinking that if I say no, they're just going to get a warrant.
So they already had consent from LaToya.
Yes.
So arguably, they could have searched the attic just based on that, is it your position that legally they could have searched the attic just based on the consent of LaToya?
Yes.
Okay. And so isn't the saying, they went the extra step and they asked for consent that they didn't even have to ask for, And now they've got a problem. You know, no good deed goes unpunished.
Well, that's what creates the problem. It's his refusal to consent. Or if he had sua sponte just said, I don't want you searching, I don't think there's a requirement that the police have to ask to trigger the rule in Randolph. I think if someone just refuses and says on their own, hey, I don't want you searching, that would still activate the rule. But once there has been a refusal, that's when it comes into play. And when a person has asserted his right, just as there's no requirement that the police inform the person that they don't have to consent, but if once consent is refused, then that triggers the rule, and that's what makes this search unconstitutional.
Thank you.
I thought there was something in Randolph that indicated that just because two people live together, that means they've agreed to abide by the other's consent to a search. What I'm trying to say...
I mean, Randolph talks about that a person, while they're physically, obviously once you're gone, when you're not, you've left or you're absent, you run the risk that the co-tenant will consent. But when you're both there, you don't lose your right to refuse by the mere fact that your co-tenant has given consent.
Your problem is here he wasn't physically present.
Well,
I would
argue that he's still physically present because he's at the scene. He's not at some different location. The federal cases that sort of narrow the holding of Randolph are all cases where the person is not present. They're either at work or they've been gone for a long. They've been taken to a completely different location, like the police station. But you know, if they just moving him across the threshold, I don't think this would be any different. Being in the squad car is any different than, let's say, being placed in cuffs and just taken to the other side of the threshold. He's still at the location.
Is there any indication here that they deliberately got him out so that they could then ask for consent and he wouldn't be present? That this was all pretextual?
I can't say yes or no. They did ask, they did invite him to take part in the threshold colloquy, so it doesn't appear per se to be the case that he was taken out. Their justification for that was, you know, it's a potentially volatile situation with his girlfriend that he's, you know, allegedly just beaten or, you know, physically assaulted, so they need to control the situation. So, and they did. So I would say that doesn't really matter per se.
Could I go back to this matter of physically present? My office is at just the other side of the wall. Is my judicial assistant physically present here?
Well, no, he's not present in this room, but he's still present at the scene, and I mean, he has a reason. He's outside, but remember, I think the operative fact here is also the fact that he was. The reason he's not present is that he has been moved by the police just outside. There's nothing in the record to indicate how far away he was, but I would say he's on the other side of the threshold, but not completely removed from the location because he's still part of the threshold colloquy. The officers who are doing the search are the ones asking him whether or not it's okay for them to search. And you know, if LaToya hadn't been there, we certainly wouldn't be saying if he had consented that consent wasn't operative because he was just a little bit farther away than, you know, just on one side or the other of the threshold.
Mr. Gould, my recollection of Georgia versus Randolph is that the U.S. Supreme Court talks at one point about the person whose consent is at issue being at the door. Now, that would indicate to me that they were concerned about the person actually being physically present at the location. How far do you push that? If you talk about a guy being removed from the home, being taken to a squad car, and being in the squad car, is he at the door?
I mean, he's not technically at the door, but he's still present at the College Avenue, the general College Avenue location, such that the police were able to walk outside and ask him, hey, can we search? And, you know, if he had said yes, there wouldn't be any problem here. So, you know, it's the general concern is the invitation to participate in the threshold colloquy at the location. And he was invited, and having asked him and hoping for a yes, then they're stuck with the no that they received. And that precludes the search of the attic. Once he said no, then they had to go, then they should have gone and gotten a warrant at that point.
But where I think some of the questioning is coming from, the interest and my own interest included, where exactly did the refusal to grant consent take place?
Well, the no took place. It's pretty clear from Officer Mattson's testimony that he went out to the van and asked St. Martin.
And I think what I'm coming at this with is how far is too far or how close is necessary. I think the word they use in Randolph is the threshold, implying the threshold of the door. Now, certainly if he's on the porch, that's one thing, but we're getting further and further from the entryway, the actual entryway referred to in Randolph. So where would you draw the line?
Well, I would say at the location. If he's completely removed, like we have situations here where the person has been taken to the police station, then he's no longer there. But I think that to just limit it to like right by the threshold, especially when it's not the location has been set by the police, allows for the police to circumvent the rule just by moving the person just outside the threshold or down to the street when they're still.
Is he in the van?
He was in the van when he refused to consent. Yes. And
what? Months ago, the Chief Justice was asking you some questions about the police removal of him from the threshold. I'd ask you to spend just a couple of minutes talking about, should we be concerned about the explanation for why he was removed from the threshold area, which was, as I understand it, for safety and in regard to the domestic violence incident to which the officers had responded earlier. Should we look at that, and if so, to what extent should that play a part in our analysis of this case and obviously an application of cases hereafter?
Well, I don't think that, I mean, that there's no indication that they were gaming the system by moving him outside. I think there was a domestic violence situation, and those can be volatile situations, and they wanted to place that to preclude any probably interaction between him and LaToya, and so he was taken outside to the van for that purpose. But he was still still under the control of the officers who were conducting the search, and they still were having him participate. If he had not gone, I conceded that if he had not gone outside and asked St. Martin to consent, then there wouldn't be any problem here. But he by going out there and including him in the threshold colloquy, he's sort of still keeping him at the scene. Because there is no requirement in the authorities for the question to be asked. But when he went out there, he was probably hoping that St. Martin would consent.
Should the decision of the court hinge on what is admittedly the superfluous question asked by the officer?
Well, yes, because having included him in the colloquy, that answer that he got, the refusal, is thereby then controlling, because the person has been.
I understand your position on that.
Counselor, what if both of them were still standing at the doorway, and the officer asked LaToya, can I come in and search, and the other guy stands there moot and then quickly is removed to the van? So what if the question is asked when he's there, the other guy doesn't say anything and is taken to the van? They don't ask him the question. You still come up in the same spot as you are now or not?
No, I would say that he could have conceivably in that situation said, hey, I don't want you doing that. Uh-huh. And that would control, but if he, by remaining silent, he basically waives his right to object, and I don't think there would be any problem with a search in that situation.
Thank you. What is the test in Randolph? Is the test in Randolph, as you read the case, physically present? That's what the Court of Appeals described it as in its certification. Is it at the door? Because there's language in the Randolph case that's just been referred to as at the door, you know, there. There's language in the case, as I recall, dealing with entrance. So what this Randolph case has been the subject of quite a bit of subsequent litigation. So what is the Randolph question? The Court of Appeals, both in the beginning and the end of its certification discussion, says the Randolph Court summarized the rule regarding refusal of consent by a, quote, physically present resident. So they think the rule is, are you physically present, and then our job in this certification is to define what physically present here is under the facts of this case. But, or is the rule more narrow than that in Randolph? Does the defendant have to be at the door or at the entrance?
Well, I mean,
why do you think what the rule is?
I would say that at the door is a subset, and it's not, that's too narrow. Physically present means at the location, and I mean, you might not be at the door. The person could be inside the apartment, because this isn't about the ability for them to enter, to arrest, or to protect a victim of domestic violence. So if the person is, you know, in the back room and they find him there and he or she refuses, that's still going to be operative even though they're not at the door, and just as they could be some distance outside. If the police are unable to invite that person, the officers actually conducting the search at the location are in a position to invite that person to take part in the threshold colloquy, and they do, that should be the operative rule, and it's still narrow enough to stay within the confines of Georgia versus Randolph and some of the decisions that sort of narrow the application of the Georgia Randolph rule.
What should we do with the Seventh Circuit cases like Henderson and Groves and Hicks?
I think they're all distinguished. When Groves wasn't even there at all, he was at work. He had refused to consent, and it happened weeks before. I'm not arguing that the refusal to consent operates in perpetuity. I mean, I don't, to confine it to that day or that period of, you know, a number of hours is okay. It doesn't operate in perpetuity. In Henderson, whether he in fact objected to the search is ambiguous. They came in and he told them to get out. But he wasn't, he had been completely removed from the scene at the time that his wife consented to the search.
What's completely removed to?
Well, I mean, completely removed is taken to a completely different location, you know, not at that address, inside or outside. I mean, I don't know how big a circle you have to draw, but I think being in the van, especially when you've been taken out to that van, is not too far for the application of the rule. But being taken to the police station obviously would be. In Hicks, there's no evidence that he objected, just as in the Matlock case that the state relies on. There's no evidence that Matlock objected to the search. There's got to be some kind of objection, whether it's sui sponte, you know, or whether it's prompted by a question. And in Hudspeth, he was at work when he refused to consent to the house, so he wasn't at the location. I would also like to address the issue of whether the search warrant, which was issued after the search, sort of cures the defect we're alleging, that the search wasn't justifiable. As I've pointed out, the cocaine which was discovered in the attic was not was already seized and taken to the police station, and it is not listed on the warrant return. So therefore, I would argue that that search warrant does not retroactively cure the fact that it was seized illegally. The cases I've cited, I can find no case that where material that's already been seized and taken to the police station becomes admissible solely by virtue of the fact that a warrant has been issued, when in fact that it wasn't seized as a result of the warrant.
What was seized as a result of the warrant?
The cocaine was seized as a result of the warrant and taken to the police station.
Counsel, I thought, just to clarify, I thought that the return of the warrant didn't show any finding of cocaine as a result of the search via the warrant.
Right.
So why do you answer me that cocaine was found? I thought the cocaine was found before that.
Yes, it was found before the warrant was issued and taken to the police station. And it was also used – another problem is that the finding of the cocaine was used as a basis for the issuance of the warrant.
Okay, so they issue a warrant. They go to the house with the warrant. What did they find?
They found the stuff that – I mean, basically, they found what they had already found.
Okay.
There may be some additional items, but the real – you know, the real –
So when they originally found the cocaine, they didn't take it to the police station, they left it in the house? Or they take it out and bring it back?
It would still be problematic under the cases I've cited, Murray and Segura, because they and Rogers, because that they had already found it. I mean,
did they remove it or they leave it there?
Well, they removed it. Oh. No, those none of those cases involved removal of items. But
what about this case?
Well, they did. They removed the cocaine and took it to the police station, and it's where it stayed. They didn't put it back.
So when they did the search warrant, they didn't find cocaine.
They didn't find cocaine.
Okay, just checking what they found with the warrant.
And I mean the cocaine is the whole case there. Without the cocaine, there's. You know, that the conviction wouldn't have resulted.
How does the independent source doctrine fit into your arguments?
Well, I mean, if they had done everything exactly right, you know, the warrant might have been issued. But the point is there are just too many mistakes here. You have an illegal search. You've got a warrant that's based that has inaccurate information and has information that was obtained illegally. You've got cocaine that's already been seized, so that it isn't even found as a result of the warrant. I mean, the number of errors and the amount of errors is such that that independent source or inevitable discovery doctrine just isn't. I don't see any cases where it's been permitted in a case like this. In some of those cases, there are some minor mistakes, but they are not. A lot of times, you know, the initial search isn't actually exploited as a basis for getting the warrant. The police officers go back and just use what they had before they went in to get the warrant, and don't use any of the information that is illegally obtained to get these warrants. And in that instance, it might have been okay, but you can't suddenly just, as the trial court did, just sort of forget about the intervening illegalities to such an extent that we just write them out of existence.
Well, didn't the trial court, and the only suppression hearing I read was the one that was in the appendix, and the trial court then went through the affidavit, redacted some stuff, and found with the information that was left that provided although he said it's close, that provided sufficient information for probable cause. That was an independent source, untainted, if you will, by misleading information or inaccuracies. Am I misstating?
That is what the trial court found. Mm-hmm. And my response would be, well, it still isn't going to take away from the fact that the cocaine is already in the police station. It's been seized. And in the cases like Murray and Segura, they're talking about stuff that is found, you know, without any of that taint and which has not been seized. In one of those cases, they excluded the stuff that had been discovered before the warrant was issued, but which hadn't been included in the affidavit to get the warrant. So that's the problem here. There's too many issues with the initial search, how the warrant was obtained, and then the fact that this cocaine is not even a product of the warrant. I see that my time has expired.
It has, Mr. Gould. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Sarah K. Larson, Attorney Larson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Larson.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I would like to talk today about the three primary reasons why this case is distinguishable from Georgia versus Randolph. First, unlike in Randolph, Mr. St. Martin was already validly arrested when LaToya gave her consent, and he was therefore not physically present, as Randolph contemplates. Second, unlike in Randolph, St. Martin was not asked to participate in the threshold colloquy at the door or the entrance to the home, as Randolph also requires. And third, unlike in Randolph, Mr. St. Martin did not register a contemporaneous or immediate objection to the consent inquiry, as Randolph also requires. Rather, police here had already obtained a valid and uncontested justification for the search in Mr. St. Martin's absence before he was ever asked and before he ever objected. So therefore, under Matlock and Randolph, they both make clear that the police were not constitutionally required to ask him for consent. So the only thing differentiating this case from Matlock is the police's gratuitous or superfluous after-the-fact inquiry.
Counselor, in regard to your third point, that St. Martin did not immediately object to the search?
Yes.
If he's in the police van and he doesn't know what LaToya says, when would you expect that he would be able to make a sufficient objection?
Well, Randolph only contemplates the situation where the two co-tenants are actually standing there together at the door, and one says yes and one says no at the very same time.
I understand that that's what Randolph says, but you had 3 points why you thought this case was distinguishable, and one of them was that St. Martin did not immediately object. And my question to you is on that point, because if that's something we should be thinking about, I need to know why you said he didn't immediately object. Mm-hmm. When should he, not to have fallen within a factor that you think we should consider? I don't remember reading when he knew that she'd consented, frankly, so that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, well, I'm not sure the record shows when he knew.
Okay.
But what happened was she was had brought the police to their house, let them in the house. He was at the entrance to the house, but he said nothing. He did not object, didn't say anything, and then he was escorted out pursuant to the valid arrest.
But they asked her after he was gone, is my recollection. Isn't that correct?
They asked her after he was gone for consent to search, but
okay.
He was not in the house when they asked her. He was already out in the police
station. Right, so how could he immediately object? He wasn't there physically, and if he didn't know what she said, I'm not quite sure how that fits.
Well, I guess under Randolph it would be impossible for him to have immediately objected because he wasn't there. But that's the whole point of Randolph shouldn't be extended to the arrest situation. It's like in Henderson where they took him away, and then they – and in Henderson, actually, he had objected when they were there, and then they took him away. So I would argue that this is actually more compelling because he said nothing when they took him away, and it was only after they had already obtained her valid consent that they then went out and asked him.
Didn't he say something to the effect that she didn't have the right to be there?
He did.
He did say that to the police, that's correct. But I think this court should keep in mind that the circuit court found as fact that she did live there, and her testimony was credible. So this court should sustain that ruling as not clearly erroneous.
Let me see. On the facts, police go to the house, mm-hmm. and at least part of their reason for going is a domestic abuse situation. Were there any questions asked of the defendant about the domestic abuse situation at the house?
Were there any questions asked of him of the...
Right in the house.
Not that I'm aware of. They had already obtained the information about the domestic abuse violation at the police station before they even got to the house, because LaToya had already gone to the police station before any of this happened. So they obtained the information about the domestic violence before that happened, and they went to the house for the reason of arresting him. So when they arrived at the house, they knocked on the door. Nobody answered. She let them in with her key, and then he was...
So are you saying they arrested him without any conversation about why he was being arrested?
I don't think the record reflects any conversation about the domestic violence, to my knowledge.
As I understand the facts, when they came to the house with LaToya and got in, they arrested him, and I don't know the conversation, but they arrested him for domestic abuse. Take him and put him in the car. It's not clear to me exactly where this car is, other than it's next to the apartment. I don't know if it's... and I don't know exactly the configuration of the apartment. But it was when he was in the car or van then that she was talking about the attic. And ultimately then, when he was already removed, being arrested for domestic abuse and domestic abuse only, when he was removed, then that's when the discussion occurred regarding the attic. She gave consent to search the attic, mm-hmm. and then they went to the van or car and asked him if he would give consent to a search, and he said no.
That's correct.
Do you know, did they ask him, would he consent to search the attic, or was it consent to search the premises? Do you know?
I believe that the record reflects that they asked him to search the attic.
The Court of Appeals was just generic about that when they recited the facts, and
right.
I wasn't sure. So the attic, how can you expect him to say, they're coming? I mean, I'm putting a little flair on this because I don't know exactly what was said at the door. But they come in, and shortly thereafter, they're handcuffing him. That I do know. And they're arresting him for domestic abuse, which I don't think has anything to do with the attic. And if the record reflects, how would you expect him to voice an objection? Oh, by the way, as he's being taken away or at the threshold, you can't search my attic. Because the attic issue didn't even come up until he was already in the van. He was there only on domestic abuse. So how does that make sense, to expect him to object to something that wasn't part of the universe of discussion at the time?
Well, I don't think that you could have expected him to object if he didn't know that that's what they were doing. But Matlock and Randolph make clear that they were not constitutionally required to do so.
You say that, and then I think, well, if it's that clear, what's the Court of Appeals doing certifying this question to us if it's an open-shut question? You know, if Randolph is that clear, then I'd say improvidently granted. But their question is, was St. Martin physically present when he was forcibly removed to a van just outside his apartment, yet was nearby and was invited to take part in a, quote, threshold colloquy regarding the consent to search? That is the last sentence of their discussion before, on page 9, before they get to the conclusion that the interpretation of Randolph in this context implicates important constitutional rights. And here, Supreme Court, you decide this issue because it's unclear. I mean, isn't that what we are about, to determine whether or not the certified question, whether under these circumstances he's physically present?
Well, I'm not sure that this court has to decide how far is too far away or anything like that. I think they can decide under Henderson and some of the other cases that he was not physically present because the Randolph case did not contemplate the arrest situation. It was only in dicta that they said that a pretextual arrest, the police are not allowed to remove him for the purpose of avoiding an objection. But that's not what happened here. Everybody agrees that it was a valid arrest.
So should we, if it's so clear, should we improvidently grant the certification? Hey, Court of Appeals, what are you doing wasting our time?
Well, I think this court can distinguish Randolph. I don't know if it's improvidently granted, but this court can distinguish Randolph based on the three factors that I said, and I think that the issue of the threshold colloquy comes into play as well, because this, it's not elevating form over substance to call it the threshold of the door, because the Fourth Amendment's protections were first and foremost concerned with entry into the home, and here they're already inside of the home, and he had no objection to them entering into the home whatsoever.
Let me just push you a little bit, so I can find out what you believe the law is. If he were not at the door but were in the kitchen and objected, is that you're saying that the test is at the door rather than physically present in Randolph? Is that, first of all, is your test at Randolph not the question asked by the Court of Appeals, but rather, was he at the door? Is that your test from Randolph?
I think the state's position is that it is, because the language in Randolph makes clear, for example, on page 13, okay. It talks about the police entry.
That's fine. I understand that. My question goes to, okay, it's your position that Randolph requires at the door. So if he's in the kitchen and they come in, is that at the door? And then answer with regard to whether or not he's in the downstairs bedroom and can hear them come in. Is that at the door? And then answer the question of whether or not if he is in the car that's in the attached garage off the kitchen. Are those at the door?
Well, again, I would point you to the hypotheticals that are raised in Henderson, which are very similar to what you're talking about. And how do we know what it means to be physically present, and there's so many factors, but I think this court doesn't need to decide that, because here he wasn't physically present. He was validly arrested. He was not at the door.
But at Henderson, he was taken to a different yeah. Mm-hmm. So if he were in the kitchen, is he at the door?
No.
Okay. So if he were in the kitchen, which is right off the front entryway, and he said, don't come in, you don't have any consent, you don't have any permission to search, they can still search because that consent, that objection is not a valid objection because he's not standing at the door. Is that your position?
I think it is, but I also think in your hypothetical it would matter whether he was asked right away or...
He's not asked at all in Justice Bradley's hypothetical.
Is he asked or did he object in your hypothetical or was he asked?
Mm-hmm. He wasn't asked, but he says...
No consent.
No, don't search anything.
Well, that's what happened in Henderson, basically. But he said, get out of my house. They took him away. Mm-hmm. And then they went in. So and they asked the third party.
Your answer to my question is, if he were in the kitchen and objecting, that is not a sufficiently legal objection because he's not at the door. Is that your answer?
Under Randolph, I don't think it would be extended that far, no. Okay, that's my answer.
Let's take a look at Randolph. And as I said, you know, they use different language. What I want to look at is the dissent in Randolph, authored by the Chief Justice and joined by Justice Scalia. And in that case, in the dissent, it talks about the Matlock case. And, of course, the Matlock case is an important case in the analysis of this case, not as important as Randolph, but important. And in Matlock, you have the facts that are, with regard to location, awfully close to what we have here. In Matlock, if I recall, the defendant was detained in a squad car nearby when the police obtained consent from the defendant's wife. And there was no colloquy. The defendant was not part of the colloquy. When I read that and looked at the Matlock case, I thought, oh, that's like this case in terms of the location. Yes. And I thought to myself, how close was he in this case? And it's not clear. It's a van, you know, nearby, right there, you know. And Matlock, it was a squad car right there. But Roberts, in his dissent, when he is discussing Matlock, says that he was physically present, that the squad car nearby, the facts in Matlock, constituted physical presence. What do you think about it? No one else addressed that in the Randolph case, that is, whether or not the Matlock facts, which are the same as ours in terms of location, constitutes physical presence. So you have two justices with facts that are, I think, the same as ours in terms of a record, a vehicle, you know, at the scene, right next door, or right there, being two justices saying it's physically present. You disagree with that?
Well, I don't think that Matlock used the physical presence test at all in the inquiry. All they talked about was the fact that he had not objected and
That's
he was
right.
absent.
That's right. But my point is that Roberts, in his dissent in Randolph, describes the Matlock facts and describes the defendant was, talking about agency, theory is belied by the facts of Matlock and Rodriguez. Both defendants were present, but simply not asked for consent. You know, in other words, the Matlock defendant, Matlock, was not part of the colloquy asking for consent, but he was present, according to Roberts' characterization of what it means to be physically present. How do you respond to that? That he's just wrong, maybe?
Well, I would respond that Chief Justice Roberts, that was in dissent, so that was not part of
That's
the
right.
holding of Randolph.
That's right. But no one in Randolph
right.
opined on this issue. You know, so he just goes into it on dissent.
Well, Randolph obviously was very controversial for the reasons that I discussed in the brief, and it was also a 5-3 holding with numerous concurrences and dissents. But the actual majority opinion authored by Justice Souter did not.
Didn't address that, correct.
Counsel, if I may, I'd like to ask you to take a few minutes, just as I asked your opposing counsel, about the definition of physical presence. Now, you said there's no real reason for us in this particular case to articulate a rule or a definition. At least that's what I thought I heard. But I think it would be helpful, because this is such a commonly recurring fact pattern, your opposing counsel proposed a very cogent definition, which is at the location under the control of the investigating officers. Mm-hmm. I would ask you if, assuming I'm interested in providing guidance to the lower courts and frankly to all concerned, what kind of rule would you propose in regard to the concept of physical presence?
The state would propose the Henderson rule that when he's in the squad car, arrested in the squad car, he is not physically present. So in other words, it's a sort of a negative definition. I don't know that you have to decide how close or what the actual meaning of physically present is if you say that he's arrested in the squad car means he's not physically present, as contemplated by Randolph. Randolph really was just talking about the situation where there's two equal co-tenants standing at the door.
Yes.
One says yes, one says no. And without more, there's nothing to give the consent overriding force over the objection. But here, in this case, the more is that he was arrested. He didn't object when they entered, and his objection was not contemporaneous. It was after the fact, and they weren't required to ask him because if they had just obtained her consent, he hadn't objected. If they had just done the search at that point, we wouldn't be here.
You know, you responded to Justice Bradley's inquiries in regard to various locations with in regard to inside the home, the kitchen, et cetera. How far outside of the home, assuming that's what I'm interested in, how far outside of the home do you think is enough to take us out of Randolph to provide guidance to all those who are concerned with future cases?
Right. I understand your concern, but I don't know that I can propose a test because we don't have that situation here. He was in the squad car. So in the state's position is that that's not physically present.
Okay. So you're drawing the you're distinguishing the facts of Randolph, and you're trying to ask us to limit it simply if it doesn't meet the Randolph criteria. That would basically be your rule. If it doesn't meet the Randolph criteria, then it's outside of being physically present.
That's correct, because the Randolph opinion itself expressly disinvites any kind of reading broader than those specific facts, and here we don't have those facts.
Counsel, I understand your argument to be directly opposite from the state's concession in the circuit court. In the state's concession in the circuit court, you conceded that the initial search was illegal. And as I read the transcript from the judge, he relied on that. He referred to that concession and took that initial search as illegal. By initial search, of course, I mean before a warrant was obtained.
Yes.
Your arguments here today are directly against that concession, although you're not, I don't mean you're not saying it, I mean, but let me ask you, are your arguments here today directly contradicting that concession?
What we argued in the Court of Appeals, which we don't have the benefit of that analysis, was that the concession of law that was made below doesn't bind this court, because it's a question
right.
of law, and we are arguing against that concession at this point in time.
This footnote, it's I think footnote 4, I might be wrong, in the certification of the Court of Appeals makes reference to you saying, okay, there was a concession in the circuit court, but this court is not bound by concession. Let me tell you, we know that. But my question is, are you bound by your concession? Can you be arguing today what you are arguing?
I believe that we can, because the state, as the respondent, can advance any argument on appeal to validate the initial search, even if we didn't advance that theory below, because yeah. that
But can you take a can you take a absolutely inconsistent approach when, you know, there's this thing called judicial estoppel. You know, mm-hmm. every once in a while we hear about that. And the third prong of judicial estoppel is that the court relied on the initial response. And here you have the transcript where the court says you conceded, and therefore that initial search is illegal. I mean, he relied on it, so how can you be standing here? I know we can do anything we want. That's what we tell each other that anyway, with regard to concessions.
Only if you hold up four fingers.
Only if you hold up four fingers. That's the rule of law. But my question is, can the state be taking an absolutely inconsistent argument contrary to their concession in the circuit court upon which the circuit court relied in finding that the initial search is illegal? Can you do that? And if so, where's the authority?
Well, my authority is, as I just stated, under various Court of Appeals opinions that, would you like me to give you those cases? That the concession of law by the party does not bind the appellate court.
And it this court, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's I have State versus Collins, which is 2002.
My question was, does it bind you in your arguments? I know that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We don't think it binds us, but does it bind you?
No one has argued that you are stopped from making the arguments you're making, have they?
No, I don't think that my opponent has not done that, and also the Court of Appeals certified this issue, and this court took up the certified issue of the initial search. I suppose you could say that that the concession is binding and this improvidently granted, therefore, or you could decide the warrant issue. But I also wanted to point out that the facts in the suppression hearing aren't quite as clear as the Court of Appeals had stated. There is a point in time in the oral ruling where the prosecutor concedes that the search of the attic was improper. But in the actual suppression hearing itself, the concession was that St. Martin had objected to the search. It was a factual concession, only stipulating as to that fact that he had, in fact, objected. But then later on, the prosecutor did say that she conceded that the attic search was improper.
You know, all this argument about physical presence, which I agree is in the Randolph opinion, although it's stated differently in different parts of the opinion, it's not consistent. I think that overlooks the basic issue in Randolph versus Matlock. The issue in Matlock, as described by the majority in Randolph, is not really relying on physical presence, but as Suda describes Matlock, it's that he never objected.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that is the basic premise of Randolph versus Matlock. Mm-hmm. And there's an undercurrent, at least as I read Randolph, you can say there's an undercurrent, that, you know, you can't be in your cell phone in Detroit and phone and say, I object to searching the house. So that you need some proximity, whatever that is. And that you can't do it, you know, every day, you know, you shout from the rooftop, you can't search my house, or have a mat, which I've seen, you need a search warrant. You want to come in? You need a search warrant. You can't do that. And that the underlying theme in Randolph is that you cannot assume that a co-tenant has authority to speak for the other co-tenant. That's the basic premise in Randolph. Mm-hmm. So in Matlock, if you never ask the other guy, hey, go ahead. But where you do ask, or where the co-tenant says no, then that is binding and go get a search warrant. That is the premise of Randolph. And they didn't really cover in Randolph, you know, how far is far enough. The theme in Randolph is where you have a non-consenting co-tenant, when the search is going to be made, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you keep referring to Henderson, but there was a very strong dissent in Henderson. Henderson is a 2-1 decision.
Right.
With a very strong dissent, in effect saying somewhat what I've just said to you. Mm-hmm. And that that you just can't remove the guy, not as a pretext, but you remove him and then you say, well, he was not present. That undercuts the whole theme of Randolph, which is based on one co-tenant doesn't bind the other if the other says no.
Right.
So I concede that Randolph says physically present. Sometimes it just says present. Talks about Matlock. It really doesn't emphasize that Matlock wasn't present. Its emphasis on Matlock is no. No one ever asked him. He never objected. So what rule do you apply and why? Now, this is a home, right?
Yes.
The most protected aspect, most protected premise, right?
Right.
So how do you make sense out of all this? I mean, it certainly doesn't make sense between the threshold and the kitchen and the garage and the, you know, the et cetera. And it doesn't make sense to just say he's absolutely physically present when he's screaming, no, no, no. And the basic premise is the guy in there doesn't have authority.
I think the fundamental difference between this case and Randolph is that the police had already obtained a valid justification for the search before.
What was the justification?
Her consent, because she gave consent. They went into the house. She gave them the consent.
He wasn't there.
He wasn't there.
Physically present. When they asked him, he said no. Had they never asked him, it might be Matlock. Might be precisely Matlock, right? But
under,
they asked him.
Under Randolph points out that the reasonableness does not require the police to take affirmative steps to get consent from him before acting upon the permission
right.
that they've already received.
Right, but you see, they did it.
Yes, they did.
So you can say ignore it because they don't have to. Is that what the state wants us to hold?
No, I think that the Fourth Amendment is interested in protecting constitutionally improper behavior.
Unreasonable.
Unreasonable by the police.
Right. So you think it's reasonable to search when a co-tenant says no?
Well, I think it's reasonable in this instance because the police shouldn't be penalized for gratuitously asking them for something that they weren't required to do under.
That's what I asked you. So is that what you want us to hold? If
yes.
the cops ask and they don't have to, then you can go in and search. That's a very narrow holding.
Well, I think if we penalize the police here for something they didn't need to do in the first instance, it doesn't really add anything to the analysis. As Justice Gableman pointed out earlier, it was really kind of a superfluous inquiry. They didn't have to do it. And so I disagree with my opponent because he says a no means a no and they can't ignore it. But I think they actually can ignore it in this instance since it's kind of akin to a search warrant where they I've already had the valid justification for the search, and then the police routinely ask for consent after they get a warrant, and then the person says no, and then they go in anyway.
Well, suppose that he's in the car and he says, gee, didn't I read about a decision in the newspaper? And then he says to them voluntarily, with no question, I don't want you to search any part of the house, especially the attic. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Same time frame, same place. What would the state's position be then?
Had they already obtained her consent,
mm-hmm.
then I think my answer would still be the same. So I see that my time has expired. Thank
may,
you.
May I ask one question? I'm
Justice
trying,
Prosser.
As I understand your argument, we have facts here in which Mr. St. Martin is right inside the door when they enter. Suppose he had actually been in the attic. Suppose the young woman had given permission, and then they go up to the attic, and he says, you can't come in here. What's the result then?
And they ask him for consent before he's arrested and taken away?
Yeah.
Then I think it would probably be a different result, but that's not what happened here because, again, we're limited by these facts that we have. It's very hard to come up with hypotheticals and say what our position would be because there's just an enormous amount of variability in what can happen. But the Randolph premise was based on the social expectation premise of what happens when two equal co-tenants are standing there at the door at the same time and one says yes and one says no. Well, under the Fourth Amendment, the rule is warrant and the exception is an exception, and that consent there without more doesn't get them in. But here, we have an entirely different situation because he's been arrested and because he didn't object contemporaneously and because they weren't required to ask him. And they already had the valid justification.
Your brief has some problems because it then says, well, if you don't accept what I'm suggesting, you know, go to a totality of circumstances, right?
If I may just clarify the state's
position. How do
position
we do that? Yeah,
on
go
the
ahead.
Second point, that was always intended to be an alternative argument.
Right, I understand that.
And our primary argument would be the first argument, that this is not a Randolph case. Randolph shouldn't be extended to the arrest situation. But I just provided the court with some policy reasons in the second argument that can also inform the discussion on the first argument. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's no true tie in this situation. If everything is equal and they're tied, the objection wins. But here they're not truly equal. So the policy reasons that are set forth in the reasonableness standard, they don't have to be adopted in a reasonableness standard. I was just suggesting that if this court wasn't going to apply Randolph, these are certain factors that are set forth in the majority opinion in Randolph that the
so
court could consider.
The court might say this really isn't a Randolph case because he's not there. So you should go back and then do the general reasonableness test, general is this valid consent kind of test, and look at the totality of the circumstances and avoid Randolph. I mean, is that a good summary of?
I think the court could also do that, yes. But the court could also adopt the Randolph standard and just say that it's distinguishable for the reasons that I've already stated. And then these policy reasons talk about the reasonableness standard and why this type of case is not the same case as Randolph.
If I may, I understood your argument regarding the reasons for adopting the reasonable, objectively reasonable test was an argument that we should adopt that test and apply that test instead of the Randolph test. Right. Did I read your brief correctly?
I think that's a fair reading of the brief. I just think that the state's position has been refined a little bit to suggest that those policy arguments can also be applied towards the first argument. So in other words, this court doesn't have to overrule Georgia versus Randolph. I wasn't trying to suggest.
That's what I understood the argument in your brief to be, that we didn't have to follow the Randolph test. Here's a test you should be following. Right. But
I wasn't
you're refining
trying to suggest that,
now.
That because the first argument was always intended to be the primary argument. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Gould?
I would just like to take issue with each of the three points that were advanced by the state as a means of distinguishing this case from Randolph. One, the point that he was validly arrested, well, that, there's no issue about that. He was validly arrested, and it's not about whether they could enter, just cross the threshold to arrest him. But I don't think that really makes any difference. I mean, he doesn't lose his Fourth Amendment rights because he's under arrest. That doesn't abrogate the warrant requirement, the fact of arrest. They still need to, under most circumstances, to get. So I think that's a red herring. The second point that the state made is that he wasn't asked to participate in the threshold colloquy because the request took place instead of inside the home or at the door, took place outside. But he was asked. I mean, the fact is that Officer Mattson went outside and asked him, and he was under the control of Officer Mattson and Officer Speaker. So he was invited to take part in the threshold colloquy, and he said no. And I don't think the state would be arguing if he had said yes, and let's say LaToya hadn't been there, the granting of consent would matter where he was, would make any difference if he had consented. So I think that is a distinguishing feature. Well, and finally, that he did not register an immediate objection. I think what the court is talking about when registering an immediate objection means an objection that takes place before the search is conducted. It doesn't. We're not talking about a large amount of time here. So exactly when, whether it takes place, 2 minutes before or 2 minutes after LaToya's granting of consent, I don't think there's nothing in the opinion that suggests per se that exactly when, and sometimes you may not even be able to know whether it occurs before or after. It's the fact of refusal or non-consent that is at play. The state also made a point or said that the police should not be punished for gratuitously asking the question. But, in Randolph, I mean, that's what happened. At some point, he refused. If the refusal is – the refusal isn't necessarily prompted by the question, but if the question does prompt a refusal, then that refusal is going to be it's going to be there. It's going to be a fact which controls whether or not the police can use consent as a basis for the search. And in this case, there was a refusal, and that refusal trumps LaToya's consent, and therefore that the search is unconstitutional.
You know, Randolph's a very, very hard decision to follow. It itself says it's drawing a fine line. We're having trouble here drawing any line, fine or thick or broad or thin. Where does it get us all? I mean, what's an overriding principle that works here that a court can apply?
Well, I think that to have a rule that is easily applicable by the police is essentially the bright line rule. If you have two people who are at the location and as stated even better by Justice Gableman than I am, like either inside the house or he's outside the house but remains within the control of the searching officers. That, and it's a simple rule. If the police get a no from somebody, they've got to go get a warrant. And it's not, and it obviously wasn't an excessive burden, because even though they made a mistake, they were able to get a warrant. So had they gone and sought a warrant based on what LaToya had told them and desisted from conducting that sort of initial kind of exploratory search, there wouldn't have been a problem. But instead, they operated on a sort of search first, warrant later basis, and they discovered the cocaine. But they could have easily have gotten the warrant in that situation. So this will just provide a lesson to the police. If one of the co-tenants says no, go and get a warrant. And if that person is at the location and in the control of the searching officers. I see that my time has expired.
Mr. Gould, any other questions? Thank you, Attorney Gould, and thank you, Attorney Larson, for a yet another Fourth Amendment search and seizure case. It's been come up a number of times in past cases and always very difficult. So we appreciate your briefs and your excellent arguments today on just one aspect of consent. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-1209-CR, State versus Brian T. St. Martin. The court will meet in conference at 3:05. We are the March oral arguments.